This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In West Virginia, representatives of the governor of that state are meeting with medical professionals to try to resolve a medical malpractice crisis. On January 1st, more than 24 surgeons put down their scalpels to protest the rising cost of malpractice insurance. Joining us now is John McCabe, city editor for the Intelligencer in Wheeling, West Virginia. He joins us from his office there. Good of you to take time to speak with us today.
Thank you, Neil. More than my pleasure.
Can you recap this story a bit for us? So why did the doctors walk out?
Well, the doctors are protesting what they claim is a medical malpractice crisis, rising cost of malpractice insurance for surgeons, especially those in specialties, orthopedic, cardiology. And they are walking out now more as a preemptive measure to what they fear their premiums could be in the next few years if these rates continue to rise.
How fast have they been rising?
Well, they've, for some of the doctors that we've talked to up here, their rates have more than doubled within the past 5 years. A lot of the doctors are now forced to carry tail coverage because private insurers have left the state over the past few years, and and they're now under a state plan, and they have to get the tail coverage to cover cases from past years that they could be subject to lawsuits on in the future.
So tail coverage, again, referring to old cases, if you will.
Correct.
Okay. So what's been the effect on health care from the walkout?
Well, the effect locally here in the Wheeling area and in the Weirton area of West Virginia hasn't been very drastic. Doctors have been available to do emergency medical cases when needed, and there's been 9 or 10 cases so far that doctors have come back to do when the patient was too unstable for transfer. But for elective surgeries and similar items, doctors are transferring, or the hospitals are transferring the patients either to Pittsburgh, some to Morgantown, West Virginia, and we also have some hospitals right across the river in Ohio that have seen a drastic increase in patient in surgeries in the past week and a half now.
What's been the response from the public?
Well, the public has seemed to be behind the doctors for the most part. I believe they understand what the doctors are protesting, but that is, with everyone we've talked to, that only goes as far until something actually happens to them and it hits home. Then it seems to be a little more of people being concerned. There is a scare right now among the public, but it's not been to the level of to where it's reached a really bad situation yet.
The governor has put together a package for the doctors that he hopes will get them back to work, and it involves what you were talking about before, this tail coverage.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he is proposing $20 million from the state's tobacco settlement to put into the state's insurance plan to help defray the cost of those doctors who are joining and for their tail coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also proposing some malpractice award limit caps for non-economic damages from the current $1 million to about $250,000 to $500,000, depending on the case,
mm-hmm.
And some caps on pain and suffering also.
Doctors are likely to accept this?
That remains to be seen. The doctors we spoke with last night like what they heard from the governor, but they also understand that now it goes to the legislature, and what eventually comes out in within the next couple weeks to 2 months may be something totally different than what was proposed tonight.
$20 million from a tobacco settlement money, that's not going to be around forever. Is this a Band-Aid, or does it really address the problem?
Well, I believe, and from what the governor has proposed, that he's looking more on the long term, not only with a temporary fix to get to lower premiums, but also some things that with the malpractice caps that several years down the road, the effects of that may begin to be felt. That's not going to be an immediate fix, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a situation that not only affects West Virginia. Pennsylvania has had a similar situation that the Governor Ed Rendell has resolved recently. Las Vegas doctors walked out last year, trauma surgeon. So I think this is a situation that is beyond just West Virginia right now.
Well, John McCabe, thanks very much.
Thank you, sir.
John McCabe, city editor for the Intelligencer in Wheeling, West Virginia, and he spoke to us from his office there. And as he mentioned, West Virginia is hardly unique. The price of malpractice protection has convinced doctors in some states to quit, retire, or relocate. In some places, specialists like OBGYNs and trauma surgeons are hard to find now, and some doctors decline to perform procedures they perceive to be high risk. Many say they order unnecessary tests to cover themselves against the possibility of lawsuits. The results, less service in many places and higher health care costs for everybody. As you heard, doctors blame trial lawyers and outlandish jury awards. Are lawsuits really responsible? Should states put a cap on malpractice awards? How much are insurance companies to blame? What's happening where you live? Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're going to hear from a range of players on this issue, and we will start with the doctors. Joining us now from his office in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Dr. William Crombleholm. He's an OBGYN at McGee's Women's Hospital, and thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Mr. Kona, for the opportunity.
So what's happening with doctors in Pennsylvania? Are they as unhappy as your neighbors in West Virginia?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, we've been trying to bring attention of the state to this issue for about 2 years now because we saw the growing need for some type of substantive reform. Premiums for medical liability have continued to escalate over the last couple of years, increasing for some practitioners as much as 200% and 300%. Over the last 6 months, what we've begun to see is cessation of services. There's a group just south of Pittsburgh that stopped taking care of OB patients on November 1st because their malpractice insurance projected was going to go from $100,000 a year to $450,000 per year, which they simply couldn't pay, so they stopped doing OB. There's a community in the eastern part of the state, similarly, where the doctors stopped providing obstetrical services in September. We've had trauma centers, particularly in the eastern part of the state, at Abington, for example, in Philadelphia, in the Scranton area, that have stopped performing trauma services because their neurosurgeons and orthopedic surgeons could not obtain, either couldn't obtain insurance at all or couldn't obtain it at a price that they could possibly pay. So what we've really seen over the last 3 months now is the curtailment of services of necessity, not because doctors want to, but because they simply can't perform the services and get insurance that we've been trying to tell the state is was going to be happening 2 years ago.
Hmm. Now, we hear this often from obstetricians in particular. You mentioned also trauma surgeons, but why obstetricians?
Well, I think the issue there is our liability in terms of infants that have a less than ideal outcome following delivery, which can happen from a whole host of things. But nonetheless, there is a perception that with any pregnancy that guaranteed there's going to be a perfect outcome. And there are a lot of things that go into what happens with a given pregnancy. People often forget that if you look at pregnancies from the beginning of conception, some 15 to 20% of pregnancies end in the spontaneous miscarriage because things weren't developing properly, which is just the beginning of an indication of the whole complex process of forming a human over the course of development. We know now that adverse outcomes such as cerebral palsy in about 80% of such cases are related to unpredictable events that happen in the course of gestation mm-hmm. and not, as was thought before, at the time of delivery itself. And so then there are children that have serious injuries and are going to need long-term care. But it isn't related really to anything the obstetrician did in many of those cases. And so the prices that are put forward in terms of that long-term care and the non-economic damages are markedly escalated. Recently, within the last year, for example, I don't know the details of the specific case, but it was an adverse outcome for a newborn. The award from the Philadelphia court was something in the neighborhood of $100 million.
Now, there are, you know, doctors, of course, have a very lengthy, difficult, and expensive training periods.
Right.
They also make a lot of money as a rule. And a lot of people, you know, yeah, I mean, they look at the, you know, this rising malpractice cost, but many people are just very unsympathetic about this.
Well, I think the issue about doctors making a lot of money in many respects, depending upon the specialty you look at, is really a myth. What's facing obstetrician gynecologists in the state now, with presuming you can get liability insurance, which a number of physicians in the state of Pennsylvania can no longer do, completely unrelated to their malpractice history. There are physicians in this state who have had no suits at all, but whose insurance company is pulled out of the state, and the remaining insurance companies won't pick them up, or will pick them up only at exorbitant premiums to be paid. When you look at the national averages and what incomes are, and look at what we're paying for malpractice, what I try to point out to people, there's a simple equation between what you have to pay out in overhead in your office and so on, and then your salaries and other aspects. And in that equation now, when you take one from the other, those equations are coming up with a negative number. This isn't exorbitant salaries that physicians have. When you look at the national averages and in Pennsylvania, depending upon the specialty, you see salaries are ranging anywhere on average between $120,000 and $150,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
This is after 12 to 14 years of training. This is with time commitments over the course of a week of 80 to 100 hours. And trying to provide care to patients. This isn't a lot of money. The notion that they're making fortunes really isn't false. There are a number in highly specialized areas, cardiothoracic surgeons and some of the other specialized neurosurgeons that may make more. But the average physician is not making fortunes.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN at NPR.org. And let's go to Carolyn, who's on the line with us from Norman, Oklahoma.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a slightly different perspective on this. I understand that the pendulum has swung far the other way with malpractice insurance being way too expensive, but in October of 1944, when my elder sister was born, had malpractice insurance existed at that time, and had doctors not been regarded at that time sort of as, you know, infallible gods, but as fallible human beings practicing a highly specialized skill, my sister, who spent her 55 years of life on this earth, mainly in the Rainier State School for the Mentally Retarded, she was a subject of severe birth trauma. My mother was in labor during the war in Asheville, North Carolina. She was in labor for hours and hours and hours, unattended. And when the doctor finally arrived, he was drunk. And he apparently used high forceps to pull the baby who was stuck in the birth canal out. And the combination of the high forceps use and the lack of oxygen to the baby's brain for about a minute left her severely, severely mentally retarded. There was no possibility in those days of any kind of malpractice insurance, but had there been, that doctor would never have, you know, had a job, and my mother, you know, I might have had an older sister who was a normal and intelligent human being. So I think there are certain advantages to malpractice, but I do concede that I think it's swung way to the other extreme at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Crumbleholm, obviously you can't speak to a case that happened so long ago. But
50 years ago,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. But the point being, have malpractice suits actually improved the practice of medicine? You know, have they led to improvements, more safety?
I don't know that one can directly relate them to the suits themselves. I mean, there's a whole lot's been done just within the individual specialties of medicine itself, looking at what are considered standard practices, establishing standards. I mean, this happened to be an obstetrical case. I can tell you the American College of OBGYN, which had founded right around that time in like 1950, has committed, the organization's whole thrust is to education both of our own members as practitioners and the public to what is appropriate care for women with both gynecologic as well as obstetric conditions.
We're going to pick this up after a short break, Dr. Crumbleholm,
okay.
So stay with us. Carolyn, thanks very much for the call. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the increased cost of medical malpractice insurance and how it's affecting the quality of health care. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. With us on the line is Dr. William Crumbleholm at the McGee Women's Hospital in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And we have an email question for you, Doctor. And
okay.
This is from Pat McHugh in University City, Missouri. Before all else, the AMA must publish an accessible, updated nationwide list of truly incompetent doctors. Now, these doctors who are finally convicted of gross malfeasance in one state can cover their tracks and set up practice in another state. My mother, a nurse, complained of the secrecy 60 years ago. Change the AMA's misplaced loyalty to their own and expose the few bad doctors who cost the insurance company so much. Then doctors can lobby the federal government, not individual state legislatures, to pressure insurers to lower their rates across the board. Are there a few bad apples that the profession itself could police out?
Well, I think, I mean, as in any profession, there are always going to be a few bad apples. But one of the things I would point out is that with the creation of the National Data Bank, part of the intent there was to have practitioners whose skills were not what they ought to be, that had resulted in serious malpractice decisions, would be listed in the central repository. It is routine now when you apply to a hospital for privileges in any of the 50 states that your track record on the National Data Bank is checked. So in the event that there were such a practitioner, that would be very evident today. The biggest problem with the National Data Bank is that many suits that are filed are really frivolous, don't reflect that the individual physician's skills, but yet they can end up being listed in the data bank, which then will require a great deal of documentation and explanation for what's going on. But that kind of information is now available and is routinely used before privileges are awarded in any hospital.
Well, Dr. Crumbleholm, thanks very much for being with us. We know you're busy, and taking time out of your day is greatly appreciated.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to respond to some of your questions.
Okay. Dr. William Crumbleholm is at McGee's Women's Hospital. He's a chairman of the Pennsylvania Association of Gynecologists, and we spoke with him from his office in Pittsburgh. Here now with us, with a different view, is Ken Suggs, a medical malpractice attorney in Columbia, South Carolina, also secretary of the Association of Trial Lawyers of America. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon.
A lot of people are outraged by what they considered, we just heard Dr. Crumbleholm talk about it, frivolous lawsuits and the huge financial rewards sometimes juries give to plaintiffs. What do you think about that?
I think that's a complete myth that's been driven by a few lawsuits that are reported in the news where there have been high verdicts. But the fact is, ordinary lawsuits don't get reported in the news. If you look at the National Practitioner Data Bank that the doctor was just talking about, mm-hmm. which, by the way, wouldn't contain anything about frivolous lawsuits because it only contains payouts.
Mm-hmm.
And the average payout...
Well, doctors would say, in fairness, that they sometimes settle frivolous lawsuits because it's less expensive to settle them than it is to argue them all the way through court.
That's not been my experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, my experience as a practitioner is that the doctors fight meritorious cases. Let me okay. make my point about the data bank, and then I'll come back to that.
Mm-hmm.
One, the data bank, the average payout is $125,000. That's all the lawsuits, and that's the money that actually gets paid. Okay, so they're not gigantic verdicts driving these medical malpractice premiums. The point about frivolous lawsuits, medical malpractice cases are extraordinarily expensive for the plaintiff and for the plaintiff's lawyer. We're not sitting out there looking for, you know, frivolous cases to file. In fact, for every 100 cases I look at, I may take two.
So in some other countries, a contingency work is not allowed. Lawyers don't get a cut of jury awards. Is that something that could happen here in a litigious society?
It would be a terrible thing if it happened here, because the fact is, when a corporation, an insurance company, or a doctor gets sued, the insurance company for the doctor goes out and finds a lawyer from a 200-lawyer firm and pays them $400 an hour to defend the claim. And if you start limiting what plaintiff's lawyers can be paid, in other words, limit what people can pay their lawyer by eliminating the contingent fee, you're just going to make it totally unfair for an ordinary person who has to go to court.
Mm. Now, you've got a lot of states, though, in this country that already cap the amount that can be paid in malpractice suits, California.
There are caps on malpractice awards, mostly in the non-economic damages arena.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with those caps is they don't address the doctor's real problem, and I'm not here to have a fight with the doctors. The doctors have a problem. They have a problem of excessive malpractice premiums on the one end, and they have a problem of being squeezed by the HMOs and the health insurance carriers on the other end, who are telling them how much can you charge and what can you do. But the problem is not lawsuits. In fact, there are 18 states with caps, and the premiums, average premiums on those 18 states with caps are higher than in the 32 states with
without caps. So if every state adopted the California law, for example, that's fine with you?
No, it wouldn't be fine with me, because it wouldn't fix the doctor's problem.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor's problem is an insurance problem. 1975, 1985, and now 2002, the insurance companies were creating this malpractice crisis by driving up doctors' premiums. And what do those dates coincide with? Low interest rates and dips in the stock market. You have to understand how insurance companies make money. They make it on underwriting, which means they take in premium and they pay out claims. They really don't expect to make money on that. What they like to make money on is investments, because they take the premium in and they don't have to pay it out sometime for years.
So they invest it in the stock market bonds or whatever.
And what happened in the stock market? The same thing happened to the insurance company's investments in the stock market as happened to your 401k plan. The difference is you can't raise somebody's rates because of that.
I'd like to. Let's go to the phones. Our number is 800-989-8255. And David joins us now from Lake Parks in Florida.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm wondering, the lawyer just now used the term non-economic and somebody else used it earlier, and I'm wondering if there's a difference between that and punitive damages, number one. And number two, is it possible, since punitive is to punish the entity that's getting punished as opposed to reward a plaintiff necessarily, why not put the money from punitive damages into some type of fund rather than into somebody's pocket?
There is a difference between non-economic and punitive. Non-economic damages are damages, for example, if your eye was put out and that didn't affect you vocationally, but you would be entitled to some compensation because now you only have one eye instead of two.
Is this pain and suffering?
Pain and suffering is a small part of non-economic damages, but non-economic damages is much more. It's the loss of a family member. Quality of life, loss of a family member's advice, loss of a mother, loss of a child, where there's no economic damage. But punitive damages are designed to do a couple of things: punish the wrongdoer and prevent other people from doing that kind of thing wrong. They're extremely rare in our system of jurisprudence, and they're as rare as hen's teeth in medical malpractice cases. There are states that have enacted, Georgia, for example, a scheme where part of punitive damages award go to the state. That's okay. But the problem with that, insurance companies would say, is where the punitive damages go to the state, the awards tend to be higher than if they go to the plaintiff.
David, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Email question from Dr. Scott Schreiber in McMinnville. I'll get that right. McMinnville, Oregon. I came to Oregon, he writes, to practice family medicine and obstetrics, and due to the malpractice crisis, I've had to give up delivering babies this year. I've had to turn away families for whom I've already delivered one child and who are again pregnant. I feel my training and expertise, as well as my absolute love of delivering babies, have all been sacrificed to the medical malpractice crisis. This is not the fault of insurance companies, he writes. It is the fault of lawyers who equate bad outcome with physician negligence and who are willing to sacrifice the rights of patients to have and choose physicians for their chance to secure the big payoff.
Well, I just respectfully disagree, because if you look at the rising premiums, they're not due to, there's no evidence. I can prove that caps on damages won't lower malpractice insurance rates. In fact, a legislative panel in West Virginia just did a year-long study and made that same conclusion. If you look at babies with what they're calling bad outcomes, I mean, bad outcomes is kind of a euphemism for a child with cerebral palsy who's blind, deaf, can't speak and move. The cost of caring for those children is astronomical. It has nothing to do with non-economic damages. It's all health care costs. And you're not going to impact the cost of malpractice insurance on those costs by putting a cap on non-economic damages, which is what's proposed.
Well, if the increase in malpractice rates, insurance rates, is cyclical, dealing with the stock market and the economy, what can change it? I mean, if this is just going to happen, is this a force of nature?
No. There are a couple of things that could happen. The doctor alluded to one of them when he said doctors who've never been sued are still having to pay high premiums. One of the things that can be done is experience-based rating. We can tell the insurance companies, look, you have to charge the bad doctors more money than the good doctors rather than charge every doctor the same. About 16% of doctors account for about 80% of the malpractice claims. The caller who said we need a national data bank is right, because we can't access, by the way, the national data bank. Only hospitals and other medical providers can access that. People have no way to know whether they've got a good doctor or a bad doctor. Another thing we can do is eliminate the antitrust exemption for the insurance company. It's the only business in America that's allowed to fix prices except for baseball.
Except for baseball. All right. Thanks very much for speaking with us. Ken Suggs is a medical malpractice attorney, secretary of the Association of Trial Lawyers of America, and he was with us here in Studio 3A. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Joining us now from his office in Rockville, Maryland, is Larry Smarr, and he's president of the Physicians Insurers Association of America, and welcome to you.
Well, good afternoon.
Your group, we should say, is not an insurance company itself. What exactly is it?
Well, the PIAA is an association of doctor, dentist, and hospital-owned or operated insurance companies formed mostly in the late 1970s by healthcare associations to provide professional liability insurance coverage for their members. Our company is currently insured over 60% of America's physicians.
Doctors insuring doctors?
Correct.
Why is that?
Well, back in the 70s, the commercial carriers writing medical malpractice insurance left the market, and insurance companies had to medical societies had to gather the capital needed to form their own companies and provide a market. And that's not too much different than the situation here today with the commercial carriers again leaving the market.
Mm-hmm. Now, how much are insurance rates rising over the past couple of years?
Well, they've risen considerably. There's no question about that, and it's varied greatly by location. In some areas, we've seen rises as much as 100%. But in states having effective tort reforms, the increases have been quite lower.
And by tort reforms, you mean caps on payouts?
That's the most significant and most helpful tort reform, yes.
Okay. Now, is the increase in your view, I don't know if you've been listening, but some have said that insurance companies are at least in part responsible for this spiraling cost of malpractice insurance because of the way they overinvested in the stock market and the bond market in the 90s?
Now, the trial lawyers are doing a great job in creating misinformation about the true nature of the industry. First of all, medical malpractice insurers are 80% invested in bonds, not stocks. Only last year, our companies had 11% of their assets invested in stocks. What is true is that the interest rates paid on bonds has declined markedly over the past decade, and they're now at record low levels. And therefore, insurers have less investment income to offset their current year premium needs. But still, last year for the PIA companies, their investment income was 31.4% of their total premiums.
So the rise in premiums, you say, is the fault of rising payouts in terms of the number of suits?
Well, and mostly in terms of the value of the average payment. Last year, the mean indemnity payment reported to our database on behalf of an individual practitioner was $310,000. And that number has been rising at 6.9% per year over the past decade.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And on the line with us is Larry Smarr, president of the Physicians Insurers Association of America. And let's get listeners involved. Here's Susie, who's with us from Worthington, Ohio.
Well, I agreed with some of the other callers, and I want to ask why we shouldn't ask that insurance, if we're going to cap the damage awards that insurance companies have to pay, why we shouldn't ask first that the insurance companies pledge to cap the premiums that they charge doctors and do that first.
Well, first of all, the insurance industry is not making money on medical malpractice insurance. In fact, last year, companies incurred $1.53 in expenses for every dollar of premium that they collected. If we did get a cap on non-economic damages, that is a good viable cap on a national basis, then you would see insurance rates go down, but not until that cap passed constitutional challenges.
Okay, Susie, thank you. There's an email question from Gretchen Buhner. Some years ago, attorneys faced this same issue. The Oregon State Bar set up its own malpractice insurance company for Oregon lawyers. All attorneys are covered. The system has been very successful. Rates are much lower than any other insurance available in the country. Why don't state medical associations, or the AMA, set up a similar system?
Well, that's exactly what the state medical associations did back in the late 1970s, and those companies are the current members of the Physician Insurers Association. They are insurance companies owned or operated by doctors, insuring doctors.
Let's get another call, and this is Mike, who's with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yes, I wanted to point out that capping judgments is unfair to the victims of malpractice, but not having tort reform of some kind is unfair to the physicians. And I believe most of the problem lies in two areas, one with the insurance companies, and secondly with how the legal system handles claims. If there would be a kind of a takeoff on the British system where if a settlement offer is made and it's refused and the winning party does better than the settlement offer, the losing parties have to pay the winning party's attorney's fees. You'd see settlements occur a lot sooner and the amount of settlements be lower.
Larry Smarr?
Well, the loser pay rule, as that's called, is also in effect in Canada. And we know from that experience that when the insurance company loses, it always pays the expenses of the other side. However, when the plaintiff loses, which is, by the way, is 70% of the time, and 80% of the time when we go all the way to verdict, it's very difficult for the insurance company to look to the plaintiff to recover its expenses, and it's routinely not done as a matter of policy. Therefore, the loser pay rule really doesn't solve anything.
Well, you have the losing attorney or the losing insurance company, a deep pocket where the payment actually could be made. It'd make the plaintiff's lawyers look at their cases much more closely. They wouldn't be trying to take a lottery ticket then.
Okay.
Well, if the money came out of the plaintiff attorney's pocket, I agree with you entirely.
Okay, Mike, thanks very much. Larry Smarr, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
Okay, Larry Smarr is president of the Physicians Insurers Association of America, and he was with us from his office in Rockville, Maryland. We're going to take a short break right now, and when we come back, we're going to take a look at a slightly different issue in healthcare. Are some Americans seeing their doctors too often? Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.